Beckham said. Start an insurrection. The new gods will have to fight us here in Texas while at the same time trying to put down an internal rebellion, all while anthrax is spreading through their networks. Ringgold's thoughts turned toward her deceased friend and vice president, the final moments of his life playing across her mind. Anything we can do to send these evil abominations back into the pits of hell sounds good to me, she said. We must cause as much damage as possible with what few resources we have over the next 24 hours if humanity has any hope of survival.
We're all about inflicting damage, Fitz said with a half-smile.
And Dr. Lovato, if I understand correctly, even if we lose the battle for Galveston, your bioweapon will continue to attack them, Ringgold said.
That's right, Kate said.
We owe it to our allies and other countries to do this, Ringgold said. Even if we can't stop the new gods, perhaps this weapon will. We'll rid the world of the monsters here that the United States inadvertently seeded the planet with. Then there will be hope for humanity. And should we survive, we can resume talks of more aggressive offensive actions against a crippled enemy. Anyone opposed to this?
Everyone shook their heads.
Good, Ringgold said. As soon as we're done here, General Cornelius and Captain Beckham, I'd like you to identify teams capable of delivering these anthrax doses to the variant network.
Yes, Madam President, they both replied. Look, I understand these strategies give us a chance, but they pull away much-needed forces to protect the people here, innocent people, Sousa said. I'm also concerned the new gods might be planning to use biological weapons like anthrax since they had it on their chimeras before. What's to say they don't also have more weapons like that they plan to use against us?
You're absolutely right, Ringgold said. General Cornelius, do you still have your stock of gas masks available?
Yes, Cornelius said. I'll distribute them among our troops. We'll requisition everything else we can to help protect our men and women on the walls.
We can help the hospital and combat medics prepare standard-issue chemical and biological warfare medications from the pharmacies, Kate said.
I can dig into our warehouses, too, Cornelius said. We inherited a great deal of the CDC's strategic national stockpile years ago that might come in handy.
Good, Ringgold said. Lastly, I've confirmed both Canada and Mexico will finally send the reinforcements they originally promised after their respective generals shared the video of Lemke's death from the new gods. When will they arrive? Kate asked. A few planes will arrive in the middle of the night.
She paused.
Unfortunately, they're just as low on vehicles, fuel, and ammunition as us. Most of their troops aren't estimated to make it until approximately 0800 hours tomorrow.
That might be too late, Fitz said.
We must hold out as long as possible for their arrival. It's up to all of you to make that happen. Any more questions?
The group remained silent.
Ringgold stood. Good. We all have work to do. Let's go make what's left of our country and those who have made the ultimate sacrifice proud.
21.
So it begins, Horn said.
Timothy sat in the passenger seat of the Humvee that Master Sergeant Horn drove, using a pair of NVGs to navigate the wreckage outside of Outpost Houston. They were on their way to a northwest suburb. Their mission was to deploy the anthrax-containing syringe on one of the alpha holes identified by a recon team.
You get some time with your girls and the dogs? Timothy asked.
Yeah, but never enough, Horn said. How was that walk? You stayed out in public, right?
Before Timothy answered, Horn spoke again.
I was watching, so I'll know if you're lying to me.
Timothy felt his face warm and fingered the bracelet Tasha had given him as he considered his response. He wasn't sure how to answer that one without getting a dressing down if Horn was telling the truth. But he had a feeling Horn wasn't here to bust his balls. The guy was probably here because Beckham had sent him to watch out for him. They weren't alone, thankfully. Not that Boyd could do much to help if Horn did want to kick Timothy in the ass. The injured soldier sat in the back of the SUV. He wore a cast from the hairline fractures in his wrist, and Timothy knew the man was in a lot of pain, but Boyd had insisted that he come along. The three of them made up one of the 15 teams that were assigned to inject the anthrax bacteria the science team had prepared.
No answer?
Horn said.
Probably for the best. It's good that I like you.
I'm thankful for that, Master Sergeant.
Call me Horn, Big Horn, but not Master Sergeant, Sir, or future dad-in-law.
He directed his NVGs at Timothy.
Dad-in-law?
Timothy was at a loss for words again, but then Horn gave him a big shit-eating grin.
I'm fucking with you, man, Horn said.
Then his face grew serious again.
Except for the dad-in-law part, don't be getting any big ideas too soon.
Okay.
Timothy gripped his rifle, trying to pay attention to the road too, since Horn seemed to be more interested in chit-chat.
Don't tell him I told you. But Beckham wanted to be here too, Horn said. Ultimately, he got stuck on wall duty.
Good for morale, Boyd said. Hell, even before I met the guy, I heard stories.
Was I in them? Horn asked.
The big ginger oaf who could squeeze the life out of a variant? Boyd asked. Of course, brother. Team Ghost was and is a legend.
Big ginger oaf better mean the motherfucking ass-kicking mountain machine, Horn said.
Right. That's exactly what I meant, Boyd said.
Timothy chuckled and watched the highway. It was devoid of life, filled with vehicles left to rot on the cracked asphalt. All the good humor they had shared quickly evaporated as they drew closer to their target. In the green hue of his optics, Timothy spotted desiccated skeletal forms lying against the side of the highway.
Stay frosty, Horn said.
He took an off-ramp and guided the Humvee down a road framed with large trees and overgrown weeds. He had to slow the vehicle as they thumped over debris in the street. Ahead, vacant apartment buildings loomed against the star-studded sky. Images of the slaughter in Vegas flashed through Timothy's mind. The broken windows and rotting balconies would be perfect places for collaborators or chimeras to set an ambush. He steeled himself, studying their surroundings for any sign of motion. The fear creeping into him now could not hold him back from their mission. Kate had told him that what they were doing could change the tide of the battle when the new gods launched their attack. They had to succeed at all costs. Horn drove past the apartments to a tree-filled neighborhood full of houses. Then he braked to a stop.
We're almost there, and we're going to hoof it the rest of the way, he said. Once we're out, it's radio silence and quiet. You got that, boys?
Yes, Master, Timothy said. I mean Horn.
Got it. And Boyd, you got the anthrax, right?
Horn asked.
Boyd patted his pack.
Ready to inject a little pain into that shit.
Good. Let's roll.
They jumped out of the Humvee, and Horn took point with his M249. Wind howled over the tall grass. Leaves rustled everywhere. Timothy directed his suppressed M4A1. He sniffed the air, trying to detect a hint of the rotten fruit odor from a variant. So far, there was nothing. No howls, no claws tapping on the asphalt, no growls. If he remembered correctly, they just needed to head northwest to a small colony that had been set up in a Houston suburb called the Woodlands. The community had a few nearby parks, along with an old golf course that had been turned into a farming operation. Horn took them toward the remnants of a fence that had once surrounded the safe zone. Most of the wooden panels and stakes had been torn apart, broken by attacking variants. Timothy followed, stepping over a segment of the fallen fence, trying not to cause any noise. His boots landed in mud on the other side with a soft squelch, and he froze, waiting for a reaction. Horn kept moving between thickets of trees and weeds that rose to shoulder height. The thought of a variant rocketing toward them beneath the cover of the foliage circled his mind. He tried to ignore it. All he could do was keep his senses honed like he had been trained. Beyond the fallen fence and mud was the golf course that had been turned into a farm. Dense weeds covered it as neglected crops rotted away. Stalks of corn wilted, leaning or folded over. Insects had chewed through much of what hadn't already died. Timothy listened for popping joints over the rustle of the vegetation in the breeze. Horn signaled the path was clear, then took them between the rows of bad produce. A clubhouse loomed at the other end of the field. Razor wire still topped the roof, along with a couple of empty machine gun nests. The tunnel was supposed to be on the other side of the structure. Already Timothy could smell the webbing. At least, he hoped it was just the webbing. The odor of decay and death drifted on the breeze as they approached. They walked cautiously in combat intervals. Horn was the first to get there. He checked the windows, then flashed a signal to move around the building. Timothy walked at a hunch, following the wall of the clubhouse to a parking lot with six abandoned cars and trucks. Even with his NVGs, he could pick up the glint of moonlight reflecting off the hundreds of bullet casings scattered over the lot. A major battle had gone down here, and Timothy wondered if any of the 200 colonists had survived. Horn skirted between the vehicles, using them as cover. He waved for Timothy, but motioned for Boyd to stay. Timothy followed, keeping closer now as they approached the rancid odor drifting from the hole. The stench grew so intense, it made his eyes water. He fought through it, until he reached the lip of the hole. A glance down revealed the same disgusting sight of red webbing crawling over the walls like tentacles from some earthen kraken. Despite the smell, no creatures emerged from the darkness. Horn looked back toward the clubhouse and waved for Boyd. But Boyd was nowhere in sight.
"Where the hell is he?" Horn muttered.
Timothy searched for their comrade but didn't see him now either. His heart thumped wildly. Not only was he injured, but Boyd carried the anthrax that was crucial to their mission. Horn motioned for Timothy and they started to backtrack toward the clubhouse, keeping low. They were losing time so long as Boyd was missing. They needed to hurry and deploy the anthrax, then make it back to the Humvee so they could return in time to help defend Galveston by sunrise. A sudden pop of gunfire shattered the eerie quiet. Timothy flinched at a throaty yell.
"Boyd."
A variant answered with a piercing howl that sounded like it was no more than a few hundred yards away. Timothy tightened his grip on his rifle and searched for the target amid the tall vegetation, his jaw clenched. As he and Horn advanced, Timothy realized he didn't feel a single hint of fear. Just anger. He was so damn sick and tired of the beasts killing his friends. It was his turn to bring fear to the enemy. The drone of the modified Beechcraft King Air 90 filled the Spartan cabin as the craft passed over New Mexico. Despite the cramped confines of the small aircraft, it felt empty to Fitz. Lincoln, Ace, and Mendez were gone, as were so many other former members of Team Ghost. Fitz couldn't help but think of Apollo, too. He would have done anything to have the dog with him now. But at least he had Rico and Dohai. Plus, the newest and strangest addition to their team, Corin, who was shaping up to be their biggest asset. He felt a twinge of guilt for not being back at Galveston, defending the island with his friends Beckham, Horn, Kate, and Timothy. The troops at Galveston were as prepared as they could be, but Fitz feared they wouldn't be able to stop the imminent assault. If the science team and the intel that Corin had squeezed from their imprisoned Chimera was right, then all hope lay on Team Ghost and taking out the Prophet. The success of this mission would be like a knife jab into the side of the new gods, finally killing their leader and liberating hundreds of prisoners in one fell swoop. He had no illusions that this mission alone would end the war, though. The new gods were likely already positioning themselves around Texas, and the First Fleet was on a collision course with the Texas beachside base, carrying an army of the Abominations. Even if their mission in Los Alamos ended in victory, would he still have a country to return home to?
"All it takes is all you got."
Fitz looked at the others, noting their determined expressions.
"And we still got a lot."
A voice came over the speakers in the cabin.
5 minutes until drop."
It was Liam Tremblay, the brave Canadian who was one of the few civilians willing to fly out over enemy territory. Fitz felt a little better having the man that Beckham had personally recommended for their halo drop into Los Alamos.
"This is it, Ghost,"
Fitz said to the others, talking loudly to be heard over the hum of the engine noise. Dohai looked up from sharpening his knife.
"Tonight, we jump into what could be the most important mission of our lives," Fitz said. "And I couldn't be prouder to do it with you."
Rico smiled, and Dohai nodded. But Corin simply looked at the deck.
I'm talking to you too, Corn, Fitz said. Never thought we'd have a Chimera on our team, but you saved our asses in Seattle, came through for us in Vegas, and you're our key to success on this mission. You're one of us now, Dohai said.
Rico smiled, but Fitz could tell it was forced. She hadn't seen what Corin was capable of yet. Soon she would be a believer.
I will do anything to destroy the people who took everything from me, Corin said in a raspy voice. I'm with you, my friends. Thank you for placing your faith in me.
Dohai held up his knife.
Tonight the prophet will take his last breath, right before I take his head.
Rico glanced briefly at Fitz. Over the past few days, they had talked about how Dohai was acting differently. Losing Ace had hit him hard, and he still hadn't mentally recovered from his captivity in the webbing. All of them had been through a lot. Hell and back, and now to hell once more.
2 minutes, Tremblay reported. Good luck. I'll be praying for you all.
Dohai stood with Corin. The Chimera strapped himself to the tandem diving harness with Dohai. Then they waddled to the hatch, where a lone crew chief waited. Rico and Fitz strode after them, side by side. The crew chief gave a thumbs up, then opened the hatch. Wind tore into them as it filled the cabin. Fitz flipped down his night vision goggles. A green light blinked above the hatch.
Godspeed, Ghost, the crew chief yelled.
Dohai jumped out with Corin, disappearing into the void. Rico went next. Fitz positioned his blades at the edge, his heavy pack filled with extra water and nutrition for the prisoners weighing him down. At the crew chief's instruction, he threw himself out. For a moment, there was nothing but pure weightlessness. Then gravity took hold, and he flipped head over blades. Wind tugged at his ACU, pulling and pushing on his body. He fought his way into a stable falling position with his eyes angled toward the ground and his arms and blades spread outward. Unlike the other team members, he was top-heavy thanks to his prosthetics. Without the minute control of flesh and blood legs, it made controlling his dive slightly more difficult as he relied more on his arms to navigate the cloudless sky. He watched both of the infrared tags below him and followed their descent. The team directed themselves to a clearing in the trees just north of the main cluster of buildings on the Los Alamos campus. He rotated his wrist enough to check his altimeter, waiting for the last possible moment to deploy his chute. Counting down the seconds, he kept his eyes on the others, all swooping into their final positions. The ground was now only 2,000 feet below them.
Wait. Wait.
1,500 feet. He spread his arms wider to slow his descent. Then, 1,000. Fitz released the pilot chute. A rapid whipping sound followed as the main parachute deployed. The harness tugged against his body as his chute bloomed outward and immediately slowed his descent. He grabbed his toggles and drifted the rest of the way down into the grassy clearing, performing a two-stage flare and then running out the momentum as soon as his blades hit the dirt. He slowed to a halt, removed his harness, and secured the chute by stuffing it haphazardly back into the deployment bag. Dohai and Rico were finishing up the same thing. They deposited the bags next to the tree trunks while Corin crouched and sniffed the air. Fitz gave the signal to advance, and Dohai moved up to point position with Corin. The two expert hunters started the trek through the trees. Dohai guided them through the trees and then held up a fist. Fitz listened for the sounds of animals or other creatures, but heard nothing. If the new gods were really here, they had likely devoured every living thing in the area. But Dohai... no. Corin had heard something. The Chimera sniffed the air and slowly scanned the forest. A distant howl rang through the trees. Fitz and Rico crouched, surveying the green forested scenery for hostiles. He couldn't tell if the howl was one of the creatures simply on the hunt or if they had been detected. Another howl answered the first. Fitz counted the passing seconds, waiting for the smack of sucker lips or the crunch of claws over the pine needles and rock. With the thermal vision, at least they had a better chance of spotting any camouflaged beasts lurking in the dark. Corin turned back to Dohai and nodded, then continued prowling through the woods.
The distant rustling of the wind and creaking of branches followed them all the way to the northern edge of the National Laboratory campus. Corin and Dohai perched behind bushes to observe the area. Fitz used a tree for cover, looking out over the pale shapes of the buildings, warehouses, and parking garages looming over the expansive campus. From their mission briefing, they had selected several of the larger buildings that were suspected sites for prisoners, and Corin was pointing right at one of them. That meant something had piqued his olfactory senses. He made another hand gesture, indicating he had detected variants. Through a screen of bushes and trees, they could see the edge of a street. Dohai made a path through the foliage and found shelter in the woods adjacent to the roadway. Directly across from them was a tall building with large glass windows and a shorter wide building with huge steel doors, but no windows. A parking garage was another 100 yards down the street. Fitz flipped up his NVGs and fished out his binos. A few human guards stood around the entrance to the parking garage, and a group of 6 Scions marched past them on patrol. They were protecting at least 2 dozen vehicles, from a handful of military Humvees to pickup trucks with mounted machine guns. Further down the road were transport trucks, parked under camouflage netting to conceal them from the air. Shapes moved around beside them. Human or chimera, he couldn't quite tell from this distance. Dohai motioned for everyone to get down. Getting down on his belly, Fitz heard why a few seconds later. The growl of a helicopter coming to life echoed through the night, followed by the whoosh of rotor blades. Moments later, a Blackhawk rose from between the buildings before accelerating toward the east. 2 civilian AW-109s and an AS-350 A-Star joined it, racing away into the night. Corin slowly got up to look at a warehouse across the street he had pointed at earlier.
"The smell is coming from there," he whispered.
Fitz nodded and prepared to give the advance signal when another rumbling engine sounded. A semi-truck trundled down the street, headlights illuminating the edges of the road. The team went prone again. Once it was clear, Fitz gestured to Dohai. The tracker rushed across the street toward the warehouse. He pressed himself against the wall of the facility, following it to a door. Then he looked into a window and turned and motioned for the team to follow. Fitz and the others joined him, and Dohai opened the door. Fitz moved his finger to the trigger in anticipation of guards, but they met no resistance as the team entered a vast, empty room reeking of something rancid, something worse even than the gruesome underground hives and web-covered tunnels. Cages were stacked in columns nearly 15 feet high. All appeared empty, though red webbing stretched between them, winding between the thin bars. Fitz roved his rifle back and forth, looking for signs of life. Nothing moved except for the slowly pulsating tendrils of webbing. Most of the enclosures were no taller or wider than 3 feet. They appeared much too small for people to fit comfortably inside. Then again, the new gods didn't care about their prisoners' comforts. Dohai pointed at the floor of one of the cages. It was covered in what looked like soil, except that it had a pungent, acidic odor.
"Guano," Dohai whispered.
"Gross,"
Rico said quietly. She covered her nose with her sleeve. Fitz looked around in a mixture of awe and fear. All these cages, the hundreds of them in this otherwise empty warehouse, were once filled with bats. Mutated creatures like the ones that had plagued the outposts of the Allied States. The odor of the guano indicated the bats had been here recently.
"Jesus," Fitz whispered.
He knew exactly where these bats were heading.
"Should we warn Galveston?"
Dohai asked, sensing his thoughts. Fitz wasn't sure. Doing so could jeopardize their mission. If the new gods intercepted radioactivity in Los Alamos, their attempt to incite a covert insurrection would be over before it even began. For that reason, he shook his head.
"They're ready. They can handle the bats."
Dohai nodded and started to lead them out of the warehouse back into the cold night on the eastern side of the building. Outside, he crouched behind a line of bushes near a street heading north. Across the way were other buildings and laboratories. Using his NVGs, Fitz spotted 3 patrols of soldiers, at least a dozen Scions. Engines rumbled somewhere else in the base. Somehow, Ghost had to get around all of them, identify the prison, recruit their army, and do it all before dawn. He looked at his watch. They were already behind schedule. The clock was ticking, and they couldn't afford to waste any more time. Neither could their friends, family, and countrymen counting on them back in Galveston. 22. Beckham strode along a steel-paneled bulwarked wall on the west side of the secured island coast. From his vantage point, he could see the sliding gate of the island's outer walls leading to the old Interstate 45 bridge connecting Galveston to the rest of Texas. The defensive forces had loaded the bridge with explosives earlier to stop a potential attack from that direction. They would sacrifice the bridge should things get bad, cutting off their only route to the mainland. But they wouldn't need it anyways. There was no escape plan. All they could do was fight to the last breath, just like the soldiers at the Alamo. He shook away the thought. This would be different than the Alamo. Beckham had faith because they had something the soldiers at the Alamo did not. Team Ghost and Kate's science team. Stars studded the blanket of darkness above them, but they were being swallowed by fast-moving clouds. A bank of fog rolled toward them from the east. I smell rain, Sergeant Ruckley said, walking beside them. She walked with a bad limp, as if each step was sending a pain through her body. This is what it had come down to, using injured soldiers, some only able to walk because of pain meds. They needed every person and every gun on the walls. They paused near the open entrance into the top level of a guard tower that looked like a pillbox built into the wall. It had reinforced walls and small windows offering shooting lanes over the side of the island. Commander Jacobs was inside speaking to a few soldiers standing next to an M249 on a tripod. The engineers and soldiers had also positioned three automated Phalanx Seawez turrets adapted to cut down any aerial threats around the island. The closest was located at the Ocean Star Offshore Drilling Rig Museum just off the pier near the Harbor House Hotel. Another was near the hospital at the northern side of the base, and the third was south of their position, closer to the airfield. Commander Jacobs finished giving orders and joined Ruckley and Beckham outside the entrance to the tower.
Everything's set. We're just waiting on the first groups to return from injecting the anthrax.
Beckham looked back toward the bridge.
No one's made it back yet?
I received word from the first few teams that they'll be back soon. Recon Charlie reported seeing a few variants out there. Most of the other groups have remained radio silent.
Any word from Recon Sigma? Beckham asked, referring to Horn and Timothy's team.
Nothing yet, Jacob said.
I'm sure they're doing fine, Ruckley said.
Beckham had wanted to go with, but he trusted Horn, and he was needed here to help with the final defenses.
Recon Sigma went to one of the farthest sets of tunnels northwest of Houston, Jacob said. I wouldn't expect them back any time soon.
And we still got a long time before dawn, Ruckley said. Trust me, I've been up and down the northeast with Timothy. Driving through Houston and injecting a bit of anthrax is nothing that young man can't handle.
I know you're right, Beckham said. How about news on the First Fleet?
We haven't spotted them yet, but this cloud cover isn't helping. Seems like a storm is rolling in. They can't hide from us forever, though. Our final aircraft are on standby to send them to the bottom of the Gulf.
Good, Beckham said.
His thoughts turned toward the men, women, and children who were too young, old, or sick to defend the base. Those who could carry a rifle were scattered on the wall with more experienced soldiers or helping to guard the civilian shelters. Even Horn's oldest, Tasha, had been given a pistol, in case things turned especially ugly.
Do we need to make another loop to ensure all civilians are at their designated shelters? Beckham asked.
It's already done, Jacob said.
Beckham nodded. He thought of Kate and her team, set up at the former University of Texas Medical Branch Hospital. They were some of the best protected people on the island, along with the engineers running the SDS equipment.
Any reports of seismic activity? Beckham asked.
Nothing to indicate any tunneling variants yet, Jacob said. We're keeping a close eye on everything.
One of the soldiers in the bunker near them called for Commander Jacobs.
Excuse me, Jacobs said.
Beckham turned back toward the west, where Houston lay beyond the increasingly cloudy horizon, wondering where the new gods would start their attack. Wherever they did attack, he was confident his people had prepared the best they could with the resources they had. Jacobs returned a few minutes later.
Just got word. The first three teams reporting successful anthrax injections into the network are less than 5 minutes from the bridge, Jacobs said.
Beckham checked his watch.
Good. We've got another 5 hours before dawn.
Still plenty of time for Horn, Timothy, and Boyd, Ruckley said.
More than enough, Jacobs agreed.
Beckham nodded and started to speak.
We can...
Suddenly, the buzzsaw whine of the modified Phalanx Seawiz turrets erupted from the Ocean Star offshore drilling rig just off the pier. 50 rounds per second exploded from the weapon in a series of bursts from its rapidly rotating barrels.
What the hell are we firing at?
Jacobs shouted.
The Seawiz detected something, an officer replied.
Rockets? Missiles? Jacobs asked.
Another burst of fire spat from the Phalanx, modified rounds piercing the black of the night. A series of smaller explosions glowed red and orange amid the low-hanging clouds.
Bats! Beckham shouted.
From the northernmost point of the base and the southern, the other two Phalanx Seawiz systems roared to life.
All spotlights on, Jacobs said. Scramble anti-air units. Shoot anything that flies.
The lights speared into the dense clouds, sparking around the base, and air raid sirens wailed to announce the beginning of the battle for the survival of the Allied States. Two of the soldiers in the barricaded tower handed out shotguns filled with all the buckshot, birdshot, and other munitions they had scraped together for just this purpose. Beckham strapped his rifle over his back and took one of the shotguns.
Get down, he said to Ruckley.
She ducked near a wall with a pistol. The weapon was all but useless against the small bats. Raising the shotgun, Beckham waited for the explosive-laden little devils. The horror they were capable of made his heartbeat accelerate in anticipation. Each grotesque, genetically modified bat carried only a small amount of explosives. But the rain of hundreds or more of those suicidal monsters over any outpost or base was devastating. The radar-guided point defense system guided the firing barrels toward unseen targets masked by the clouds. More explosions rolled through the sky, followed by miniature rumbles of thunder. The fog slowly covering the base made it damn near impossible to get a good visual on any potential targets. Beckham roved his shotgun wherever the phalanx aimed, waiting for the first of the mutated beasts to descend like miniature demons from hell. A couple of soldiers got antsy and fired.
Hold your fucking fire until you have a target, he yelled over the noise. Ammo doesn't grow on trees.
I thought we had until morning, Ruckley shouted.
She held the pistol in a shaky hand and aimed it at the sky.
This is way earlier than the Prophet said they would attack.
Did you really trust that beast?
Beckham yelled back. More booms rocked through the sky. Beckham could smell the odor of burned flesh and explosives. The first of the Seawizes suddenly stopped firing. The second followed soon after, and less than a minute later, the third went silent. The sirens continued to blare, but Beckham could hear conversations over the noise.
Is that it?
A soldier in the tower called.
Did we stop them?
I think so, another said.
Jacobs had his hand pressed against his ear, listening to his radio.
Negative. The phalanxes are out of ammunition. The bats are still coming.
A small silhouette flickered underneath the clouds, caught in a spotlight. Beckham twisted, adjusting his aim, and fired. His shotgun kicked back against his shoulder, and the bat disappeared in a spreading fan of flames that illuminated the clouds. The small explosion revealed an entire flock of bats. More booms of shotguns rang out in a deafening chorus. Each shot cut through the beasts, setting off chain reactions of explosions as the bats flocked together. All Beckham could do was aim, fire, pump in new shells, and repeat. He blinked past the sweat trickling over his face, the smell of burning flesh growing stronger and closer. Heat washed over the guard tower platform as the bats advanced their relentless attack. The first explosion rocked one of the buildings behind the walls. A scream filled the night, followed by a radio transmission calling for medics. Other explosions ripped through buildings, former hotels and restaurants and offices bursting into flames from the blasts. Nearby, a cloud of bats rocked into a section of the western wall. A chain of blasts kicked up clouds of smoke and fire. Razor wire, soldiers, and weapons disappeared in a blinding flash. Beckham tried to keep his aim on the bats above his position, but each resonating blast stoked the images of Javier and Kate and Tasha and Jenny in his mind. He tried to turn off the tide of emotions and become the machine he had once been in battle, but never had that been more difficult. Adrenaline pumped through his vessels, his mind shutting out the chaos. He focused on the descending monsters as the fight to stop the beasts grew more desperate. The shells he had had in his pockets, bandolier and tac vest, were now gone. He reached into an ammo box placed near his position, grabbing the few remaining shells, then pumping them into his shotgun. The spotlights continued to probe the clouds, shotgun blasts and explosions echoing over Galveston. He expended the final shells and switched to his M4A1. The weapon was nowhere near as suitable for taking down flitting airborne targets like the shotgun, but he had no choice. As soon as he brought it up, the explosions faded away until there was only the emergency sirens and screams of the injured and dying. A light rain started to fall, but it wasn't enough to put out the raging flames. Beckham checked the tall form of the hospital toward the northeast, silhouetted in the fog, relieved to see no flames were leaping from it. At least for now, the science team was safe. Ruckley cautiously lowered her pistol. That wasn't just a warning, was it? Just to show us they still hold all the cards? Yeah, Beckham said with a grunt. He maintained his aim on the clouds as rain splashed over his face. It would be just like the new gods to send a follow-up attack when they had let their guard down and were helping the injured after that slaughter. The new gods soon proved he was right. A few more bats fluttered from the clouds, and the soldiers opened fire. This time, there were no explosions. The dead bats spiraled to the ground. One landed just outside the wall. "Captain, look," Ruckley said. A cloud of what appeared to be white smoke spread from the dead bat. "Gas attack," he shouted. "Masks, now!" He pulled on his own mask and strapped it over his face. Jacobs passed on the warning to the wall garrison, activating a new alarm that shrieked over the base. Soldiers on the wall and in the tower near Beckham fixed their masks into place. But for those who had been injured in the explosive attack, there would be no escaping the poison spewing from this new round of bats. The second wave of beasts had landed throughout the base, tendrils of white smoke spewing out from the small canisters attached to their bodies. As flames continued to chew through the surrounding buildings, poisonous gas filled the night air. The attack was quickly becoming deadlier than he had feared. At this rate, he wondered if they would even survive until dawn to meet the real monsters. Dohai ducked behind a parked semi-truck. A group of chimeras marched down the street with cutlasses strapped over their backs and rifles cradled over their chests. Corin knelt beside him, and just a few yards back, Rico and Fitz were positioned behind a jeep just behind the truck's trailer. They had scoured another building large enough to serve as a prison. All they had found was pulsating webbing and rotting corpses. For all Dohai knew, that cavern of death could have been the former prison they were looking for. As their mission wore on, he worried the army they had sought to raise might not exist. Searching building by building had only deepened those fears. Ghost needed a shortcut. A quicker way to find the prison, if it did still exist. Dohai ducked at the sound of more footsteps headed their direction. "Humans," Corin whispered. Dohai risked a glimpse around the tires, seeing the chimera was right. All four collaborators walked casually down the street. "Our ticket to the prison," he thought. As the collaborators drew closer, Dohai whispered a plan to Corin. The chimera listened intently, nodding, then crouched near the front of the truck, ready to intercept the collaborators. Dohai remained hunched behind the tires, peering around the rig. Fitz and Rico had disappeared behind the jeep. Before the men passed in front of the semi-truck, Corin strode out in front of them, feigning the confidence of a new god's scion. "What are you doing?" he said with a growl.
Did you not listen to your orders? You're supposed to be helping me with prisoners.
But one of the collaborators began, looking at the others in confusion. Corrin snarled and cut the man off.
Say another word, and it will be your last.
He turned and began walking behind the rig.
Follow me, or you'll be the next strung up on the webs.
The four men did as instructed. As they trailed the Chimera, Rico and Fitz sprinted around the other side of the truck to ambush them from behind. Corrin stopped and looked at Dohai, giving him a slight nod. At that signal, Dohai lunged from his hiding spot with his hatchet in one hand and knife in the other. The hatchet crunched heavily into the lead collaborator's skull. Corrin drew his cutlass. The blade sliced through the air in a violent swoop, the gruesome weapon lopping off the head of another collaborator. The other two turned to run, but Rico and Fitz cut them off with their weapons leveled straight at them as Dohai retrieved his hatchet.
Make a noise, and you're both dead, Rico said.
The collaborators both halted and held up their hands. Dohai relieved them of their weapons, and Corrin aimed his cutlass toward the men.
I'm only going to ask you this once, Fitz said. Tell us where the prisoners are.
Neither answered.
First of you to tell me gets to live, Fitz said.
The linear accelerator,
one blurted. The other collaborator tried to run, but made it only 3 steps before Dohai's hatchet hit the man in the back of his head. Dohai walked over and yanked it out with a wet squelch, eyeing the final collaborator. The captive man stared in horror. He was young, maybe in his 20s, with a long beard and floppy ears like an alpha variant.
Let's go, Fitz said. Bring him.
If you lied to us, your death won't be nearly as quick and easy as your pal's, Rico said.
She bound his wrist with plastic ties, while Fitz took his Shemagh scarf off and fastened it around their prisoner's mouth as a gag. Dohai knew exactly where the linear accelerator was and took point, leading the group back into the shadows of the base. Every few minutes they paused to hide from hostiles, progressing slowly toward their target destination. Their trek took them to the outskirts of the laboratories, where the forest once again bordered the streets. The cover of the trees allowed them to advance without having to stop for patrolling guards, and they reached the northernmost entry to the linear accelerator facility. A group of 4 Chimeras stood guard outside the entry, cradling rifles. Even from where Ghost hid behind rocks and trees across the street from the accelerator facility, Dohai could smell the overwhelming odor of humans forced to live together in close confines. Fitz gave the order to take the Chimeras down. Suppressed rounds tore into the fleshy parts of their body unprotected by body armor. 3 dropped immediately, but 1 survived the gunfire and lifted his rifle to fire. Dohai finished the beast with a shot to the face that cracked through the night. The team bolted toward the corpses, with Corrin handling their prisoner. It turned out the man wasn't lying. As soon as they cleared the entry, Dohai flipped up his NVGs to see a ghastly scene. Sickly yellow lights hung overhead, illuminating red webbing that covered the lengths of wires and pipes stretching further than he could see. Everywhere he looked, he saw bodies cocooned in those webs. He scanned the vast space for guards. Seeing none, he started to check the closest prisoners. While some looked like little more than sacks of flesh and bones, many appeared stronger. That was good to see. The team had brought a few extra bottles of water and nutrition, limited by the weight they could safely dive with, but it wasn't enough. Not even close. Mouths that weren't clogged with red vines called out for help. Dohai went to the closest one. It was a woman who looked to be in her 20s wearing a soiled ACU. He cut away the vines holding her in place and then caught her when she sagged forward.
Hold on, he said. I've got you.
He helped her down to the ground.
Water,
she muttered. Dohai reached to the side and grabbed his bottle, bringing it to her lips.
Not so fast, he said. Easy.
She looked familiar to him, but he couldn't quite place her.
It's going to be okay, he said. We're going to get you out of here.
You are here to save us?
Yes, Dohai said. What's your name?
Corporal Esparza.
She glared over his shoulder at the collaborator. As soon as Dohai had freed her, he grabbed the man by his beard.
Wait, no, you said—
The collaborator started. Dohai pulled him to the ground and stomped on the side of his face, knocking him out. He looked over at Corin.
Sling this bastard up in one of those cocoons.
With pleasure, Corin said.
While the Chimera dealt with the collaborator, the rest of the team worked on freeing the others. As the group of liberated human prisoners grew, those strong enough started to help. Ghost shared the extra provisions and water they had brought, helping to rejuvenate the prisoners, even just a little.
What's your plan?
Esparza asked. Fitz handed her a rifle they had taken from a Chimera.
We fight, and you help us.
The woman wiped blood and dirt from her face and smiled. But Doha noticed some of the freed prisoners looking at Corin skeptically.
What the fuck is this beast doing with you?
Asked one of the men.
He's with us, Fitz said.
You trust this thing?
He's the reason we found you all, Rico said.
You all owe him your life, Fitz said.
Esparza turned to the others.
This is Team Ghost. You've heard the stories. You know what they've done. If they trust this Chimera, we should too.
A few of the released prisoners grunted their agreement. The man who had initially voiced his concern over Corin gave a reluctant nod.
Keep working, Fitz said. We need all the help we can get.
Are we getting reinforcements? One of the prisoners asked.
You're looking at them, Dohai said. Everyone else is fighting for survival in Galveston. There's barely anything else left of the Allied States except that island and us tonight.
Jesus Christ, another prisoner said. Do we have more guns than the ones you brought?
We're going to have to get more, Rico said. Corin pointed down the corridor.
There are more weapons in here.
An armory?
Fitz asked.
No. Beasts like me, Corin said.
Dohai, go with Corin to release them, Fitz said. Rico and I will organize the others.
Dohai and Corin hurried toward the other end of the accelerator. He searched down his scope again to ensure no guards had entered the facility yet. They stopped when they reached the section where the fallen Chimeras were secured against the walls. Their scarred bodies were wrapped in even more glue and vines than the normal humans. The golden eyes of the first prisoner watched. A patch of glue adhered to his sucker lips prevented him from talking. As soon as Dohai pried off the strip with his knife, the Chimera screamed in his face, forcing Dohai back.
Quiet, he said.
Just kill me,
the creature wailed.
I won't work for you any longer.
Corin jumped over to help.
It's okay. We're friends. We've come to free you.
The Chimera glared at him, then back at Dohai. For a moment, Dohai worried he was going to have to kill the beast. The Chimera's face remained in a snarl, saliva dripping from his teeth. Other Chimeras covered in webbing watched, their golden eyes studying Corin and Dohai.
We're here to free you.
Dohai turned to speak to all of them.
We need your help to fight back against the new gods.
He faced the first Chimera again.
Join us, Corin said. We might not win against the new gods, but we will die fighting as free.
Men, Dohai said.
The creature held his gaze and nodded. Dohai finished cutting him down, and Corin started on the others, using his claws to tear through the tendrils imprisoning them. 10 minutes later, a growing group of freed beasts had started to cut down the rest of the fallen Chimeras. Some spoke in low, growling voices, musing about their newfound chance at revenge. Dohai counted 25 freed Chimeras when the doors to the other end of the linear accelerator opened. All of them turned to a group of 6 collaborators who rushed in with weapons. The collaborators stopped in their tracks when they saw the freed horde.
You want revenge? Corin said. Now's your chance!
The group rushed toward the collaborators. None of the men even bothered to fire. They turned and ran, their terrified screams echoing throughout the facility. Dohai aimed his rifle and shot their legs one by one. The Chimeras caught up to the collaborators writhing in agony on the ground, tearing into their flesh. Blood splashed across the floor as the beasts got their first taste of revenge. With the other freed prisoners behind them, Fitz and Rico caught up to Dohai. The three of them picked up the collaborators' weapons and began handing them out. Rifles, pistols, knives, and even a machete.
You have my army, Master Sergeant, Corrin said to Fitz. Now put us to use.
23. Sirens wailed over the constant patter of rain, but above the clamor, Kate heard the faint voices of those injured in the bat attacks screaming throughout the hospital. She was a few floors below in the hospital's former clinical laboratory, but their cries carried through the vents. While most of the patients were receiving intensive medical care, including the use of respirators and ventilators to keep them stable, those who were most ill would endeavor recover without the right antidote. That was something she and her team could help with. In an isolated portion of the cab, Leslie and Ron had already prepared reagents for assays to analyze samples from the gas attack. Kate was in the main section of the lab with Sammy to monitor the remote computer stations left connected to the webbing in Houston. Although they couldn't decrypt the signals flowing through the network, they could monitor the total volume of signal activity. On the other side of the lab, engineers monitored reports from the seismic detection sensors installed around Houston and Galveston. Kate supervised it all, going from station to station. She was back with Sammy when the door burst open. A combat medic entered, sweat dripping down her face. Her ACU was covered in blood and ash. She carried a tray filled with small plastic vials. Ron emerged from the isolated section of the laboratory when he saw her.
Dr. Lovato, we've got the first set of blood samples, the medic said.
Kate handed the tray to Ron. He rushed them back to the isolated section of the lab where they had prepared the standard point-of-care blood analysis assays to detect potential toxins.
How long does this take? The medic asked, shifting nervously as she watched Leslie and Ron go to work.
Just a few minutes, Kate said. These tests were developed well before the Great War in response to potential nerve agent attacks in the Persian Gulf War. They're designed to be quick.
Good. The doctors want answers now. At least 50 patients we brought here are in serious condition.
What did the symptoms look like?
Nausea? Vomiting?
A large portion of the patients reported intense pain in their muscles, and many are having trouble controlling their limbs.
Definitely some kind of nerve agent.
Kate wanted to scream. The evil of the Prophet and his army was unmatched by any of the creatures or men she had faced in the past.
That's what we thought. We already got everyone in the hospital. It was hell out there. Now all we can do is treat the symptoms until we get definitive answers.
Ron emerged from the isolated portion of the laboratory after another few minutes.
I've got the results from the first blood samples.
He handed her a printed out page. Kate skimmed the report.
We can confirm organophosphate poisoning in all these samples. Definitely a nerve gas.
She scrolled through the report.
We're looking at Soman. Soman, got it, the medic said. Not sarin or tabun, then. Do you have recommendations for the best antidotes?
Same as sarin, Kate said. Atropine and pralidoxime chloride. Do you have them available?
All the military med kits we prepared contain antidotes for sarin, the medic said. We should be good.
It's crucial that we administer them now. They won't be effective if we wait too long.
Thank you, doctor, the medic said, hurrying out of the lab.
Good luck. Kate was glad to have helped, but she knew the death and misery had just started. Soon they would be dealing with the injuries from gunfire and claws that she had seen far too many times. As if in answer, a thunderous boom shook the hospital. She braced herself, waiting for an explosion. One of the computers chirped, indicating a seismic disturbance.
Just thunder, said the engineer, monitoring the screen. The storm is messing with our equipment, but that's all it is.
Kate exhaled.
Ron, I want you and Leslie to continue processing the blood samples. Just because we found Soman in the first few doesn't mean that's the only thing the new gods were using.
You got it, Ron said, then returned to the isolated portion of the lab. Kate moved to the section of the lab where the team of engineers were monitoring seismic disturbances.
Have you picked up anything unusual? Kate asked.
No, Dr. Lovato,
the engineer replied. The only seismic activity we detected was from the explosions hammering the ground around Galveston. After that, it's been quiet, except for this storm. So far, it seemed the new gods hadn't been tunneling into the ground anywhere near Houston or Galveston. Cries sounded from the hallway, and Kate looked up just as another gurney was pushed past by two paramedics. A patient on it writhed in pain, covered in blood and blackened skin. Kate's thoughts rushed back to the shelter where Javier, Tasha, and Jenny were. She had checked in with Connor twice now, and he had reported that they had been safe from the blasts and the gas. The knowledge did nothing to assuage the dark feelings hanging over her mind, like the storm over Galveston. She went to Sammy's station, trying to keep focused. How many teams have delivered their anthrax samples? So far, six, Sammy said. I'm seeing a slight reduction in network signals. You think it's working? We won't know for sure unless we can kill off more of the webbing. The infection isn't instantaneous, so it's no surprise that it's taking a while. Kate looked at the computer. Can you quantify the damage we've done to the network? Keep in mind the situation is evolving, but as the bacteria propagates, so too does the signal attenuation. I'm noticing a drop-off in the overall numbers of signals at about 5% right now. That's not much at all. No, it isn't, Sammy said. We only have a couple hours until dawn and the new gods show, Kate said. The color drained from Sammy's face. Kate had a feeling she knew what Sammy was thinking. If at least a few more of those teams don't get their injections into the webbing soon, it's not going to make much of a difference for us, is it? Kate asked. Correct, Sammy said coldly. Kate clenched her jaw out of anger. She had truly thought their work would have a more substantial impact tonight, but it seemed their efforts might not really affect the network until after the fighting was over. Sammy looked like she was about to say something, but the radio next to her computer buzzed to life.
Dr. Lovato, this is Commander Jacobs. We're confirming Recon Omega is reporting another successful injection. They're now returning home.
Good, Kate replied. Can I have a sit rep on the other teams?
Recon Tango and Recon Oscar are confirmed KIA. November and Kilo are MIA, but lost transmissions indicate probable KIA. We lost contact with Recon Delta and Echo. Sigma is still out there, but ran into hostiles. They've been radio silent since.
Kate clenched her jaw again at the mention of Sigma. That was Horn and Timothy's team. She shook away her fear and decided the only thing she could do right now was believe they were still alive. She couldn't bear the thought of losing them both. That's not enough, Sammy whispered. It won't cause a collapse if we don't get at least another bolus injected. Kate stared at the map of the planned injection sites on the monitor. The dot representing Recon Sigma's target glowed red. There's still hope, Kate said. If Sigma is out there, they'll come through.
Yeah, maybe, Sammy said, sounding dejected.
Horn and Timothy know what they're doing. They have to survive. We've just got to trust them. She said it as much to convince herself as Sammy. Another chirping computer pulled Kate's attention away from Sammy's computer, and she rushed over to the engineering team. Is it the thunder again? She asked. Stepping between two of the engineers, she watched spikes of seismic activity scrolling across the screen. No, one of the engineers replied. This is happening across the northwest side of Houston. If I'm reading this right, we've got at least five separate groups of variants traveling through the tunnels and making new ones. Inform command, Kate said. The engineer nodded to another man who picked up the radio. Kate looked at a map of Houston and Galveston that showed the epicenters of the detected seismic activity. One of these points was moving close to the woodlands, toward the northwest of Houston, right where Timothy and Horn were supposed to be. The second wave of the new gods' attack was coming, and they were right in the path.
Recon Sigma, this is command, a communications officer said over Timothy's radio. Seismic activity confirmed near your position. Variants headed your way, ETA 10 mics.
Sigma 1, copy, Horn replied.
Be advised you're the last team in the field. We're all counting on you.
Copy, Horn said.
Timothy caught his gaze.
You heard him. It's up to us, Horn said.
and we're not going to disappoint.
Rain fell over them in waves as they continued to follow the trail of clawed footprints in the mud. Blood covering the smashed grass showed where the beasts had dragged Boyd away. The sheer amount told Timothy that his friend was no longer alive, but hopefully he still had the anthrax they needed to inject in the webbing. Timothy thought he felt the ground rumble slightly beneath his feet. He hoped it was just his mind playing tricks on him, and Command was right about them having a full 10 minutes. He gripped his rifle in his soaked gloves and angled the barrel down the path. It led them into a neighborhood and over the front yards of two houses. Thunder rumbled overhead, lightning cutting through the sky. They passed through another line of trees, following the trail through a yard of overgrown grass. Horn motioned for them to get down at the sound of squawking and scratching claws on the adjacent street. Timothy ducked low in the cover of the overgrown grass. He crept through the grass with Horn to get a better look. Next to a rusted-out pickup truck, nearly 100 yards down the street, Timothy could make out 3 twisted shapes headed north. They were dragging a large body behind them.
"They still have Boyd with them," Timothy said.
He brought his rifle up just as the beast started to disappear behind a minivan.
"Can't get a clear shot now."
"We gotta take them out before they get wherever they're headed," Horn replied.
He signaled to the backyard of the house. They ran hard to cut off the variants. After passing by rotting decks and rusted swing sets, they raced back to the front yard of another house. They took up firing positions between 2 cars parked side by side on a driveway, and Timothy flipped up his NVGs to peer down his scope. The 3 creatures skittered toward them, still a couple 100 yards from the south. They had plenty of time to set an ambush. As Timothy centered his sights on the first variant, he noticed a collar around its neck.
"You were right," he said to Horn. "Someone's controlling these thralls. As soon as we open fire, whoever's in charge of them is going to come after us."
Horn readied his M249, setting up its bipod on the hood of 1 car, aiming north.
"I'll deal with the collaborators, or whoever the hell else might be here if they show up. You take the beasts down."
"You sure?"
"We got no other choice, kid."
Timothy aimed at the diseased flesh of the lead monster dragging Boyd. A hot anger rushed through him, and he squeezed the trigger. Rounds punched through the chest of the monster, and the grotesque mutant collapsed to the wet asphalt next to Boyd. The other 2 creatures let out furious roars and got down on all 4s. Timothy lined up his sights and held in a breath as they barreled toward him. He squeezed a burst off into one of the beasts, rounds lancing into its barreled chest and limbs. Blood sprayed from the devastating wounds as it tumbled over itself, skidding across the asphalt. Before he could adjust his aim for the 3rd monster, gunfire north of their position exploded behind him. He had been right. The assholes controlling the variants weren't far. Rounds pinged against the car where Horn had propped up his M249. The heavy thump of the machine gun was nearly deafening, drowning out the shrieks of the monster galloping toward Timothy. His world narrowed down the scope of his rifle. He took another breath and squeezed the trigger. The bullet found the target, but it still kept coming.
"What the fuck?" Timothy said.
He centered his aim again with the creature only a few yards away. The burst finally knocked it off course, and it slid across the ground. Timothy put a final round into the head just to be sure. Then he turned to look in the direction Horn was firing. 2 collaborators ducked behind cars, trying to get close. When they made a move, Timothy took one of them down, and the 2nd man dove for cover. A spray of rounds from the M249 cut down another enemy rushing down the street for a new position. Timothy roved his scope over the body to